This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
The next paper is a view from a Smithsonian person who couldn't make it. Now, this symposium, like all huge exercises, has a few human mishaps. We don't have, you know, barges getting stranded on reefs, but we do have planes getting late, and we do have things like illnesses in the family and various other interventions. So thus, Paul Taylor was unable to be with us here today, and Martin Thomas, who has a lovely voice, I'm sure you've all agree, just to embarrass him. He's going to read the paper for Dr. Paul Taylor. Now, of course, Martin was awarded a Smithsonian Institution Fellowship in 2008, so he's sort of been there, done it, knows it fairly well, and is very therefore appropriate to deliver the paper, which is entitled Historic Perspectives on the Smithsonian's Participation in the Arnhem Land Expedition. Thank you. So bear with him if he's reading someone else's paper. He's not responsible for the views expressed with him.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Paul has sent me a slightly difficult task. It's a great shame that he's not here to present it. And like all of us have written longer papers that are going to be published in a volume of proceedings so that you can, in the future, revisit this event in various ways. Now, I'm not going to try to read through Paul's full paper, or Margot's going to get terribly cross, and perhaps some of the rest of you as well. But what I'm going to do is take you through the graphics that that Paul has supplied, and give you a bit of a talk about the Smithsonian Institution, which I had the great fortune of visiting last year, as Margot said, as a Smithsonian Fellow. Now, Paul Taylor is a curator of Asian collections at the institution. And really what we wanted to do in this session is to give context, and Kim Beazley, in I think quite a wonderful way, has given political and international context. We've now got this sort of layer of institutional contexts that we're going to work through. And the Smithsonian Institution was a great influence on the Arnhem Land Expedition, because Charles Mountford, having gotten original support from the National Geographic Society in 1945, and having been offered an initial grant of $10,000, as Sally explained, then went and made a trip down the road. Also based in Washington is the Smithsonian Institution, and it's the major museum complex, almost a little sort of empire of museums and art-related and scientific institutions. And, of course, one of the great research establishments of the world. So Paul's given us here a little map of the institution. The part of the institution that is most relevant to our story is the National Museum of Natural History. For those of you who've been there, it's situated on the Mall in Washington, which is this central boulevard, and the Smithsonian started really just in one building in the 19th century. We'll get to the very beginnings in a minute. But it was started from a bequest left by a man named James Smithson, who interestingly, had never been to the United States. He was... there's a wonderful biography of him out now. But Smithson was a chemist of some note. He became a member of the Royal Society at a very early age, and He also made money from investment. He wasn't born rich, although he was born. He was the illegitimate son of the Duke of Northumberland. And his father never really acknowledged him from what his biographer can make out. And so Smithson had this quite interesting life, being connected with one of the leading families of Great Britain, but not being acknowledged, making his own way as in the mode of gentleman scientist. And what's proposed by Heather Ewing in the Smithson biography is that Smithson had indeed intended to leave his money to the Royal Society, and it was a very substantial bequest, but things went awry there in some way. I'm not exactly sure how, and he ended up deciding to leave his considerable fortune to the Republic of the United States, and it would be an institution for the where we've got the phrase here. It's for the essentially for the furtherance and diffusion of knowledge to mankind. Smithson never said at the beginning it was to be a museum as such, and in fact, possibly he was thinking of something more like the Royal Society. It seems that having received this very large bequest, the United States Congress was actually in a bit of a dilemma and thought, oh, you know, can foreigners really just sort of leave fortunes in our name for particular purposes? And also there were other claimants to the will, of course, but it didn't really get going until 1846. And they built this rather remarkable building that you can see here on the mall, still part of the institution. They call it the castle. And we're told that it initially included an art gallery, a lecture hall, a library, a chemical laboratory, a natural history laboratory, and a science museum. And anyway, it all grew from there. And one of the issues, which we'll come to shortly, when the United States had an exploring expedition, and again, it yielded lots of really interesting collections, these were then stored, and eventually they went across to the Smithsonian Institution. Museums and nation building tend to go hand in hand, and again, expeditions play a role in all these sorts of things. So Paul's given us here just some insights into the various buildings. So the second building was a national museum. They now call it Art and Industries, but a national museum is a big part of the Smithsonian, and they have everything from, you know, Dorothy's shoes in The Wizard of Oz and George Washington's overcoat, or you know, things like that. So various sacred objects in terms of the history of the nation have been collected. But here we have the National Museum of Natural History, and that's the third building of the Smithsonian. And it's still where many of the expedition 1948 expedition collections are housed. Now, what Paul very much wanted to communicate was that kind of what we're doing here with an expedition is going on internationally, and that lots of people are dealing with the legacies of various 19th and 20th century collecting enterprises. And he himself has been involved in a number of these projects. And, already I think today you've had a taste of the multimedia dimension of these expeditions, where we're getting film, sound, photography, documents, and these events begin to start making a lot more sense when you find ways of putting the different streams of data together. and online resources offer a really interesting way of opening up some of this. So these are things that you can actually visit and explore on the Smithsonian website. But the United States Exploring Expedition of 1838 to 1842, and I think Adrian Kepler is going to be talking about this later in the program, is a very important event. And this was set up very much in terms of looking for trade routes and that kind of thing, and is a very interesting example of the United States, a still a fairly new republic, extending itself into foreign territory, you know, somewhat in the mode of these earlier famous voyages such as Cook and so forth. So this is one website that they've set up where you can actually follow the US exploring expedition. Other projects that Paul is working on is the expeditions of William Lewis Abbott, 1860 to 1936, and the 1926 Dutch and American expedition to New Guinea, known as the Stirling Expedition. And it was really through the latter project that I came into contact with Paul, because I began looking at various other approaches to the researching of expeditions and the display of findings there. So Abbott worked in East Africa, Madagascar, Seychelles, and you know, had a number of these trips, one of these roving explorer kind of guys who goes out and collects lots of material. I don't think we'll get too involved with the letters, but just to give you a bit of a visual tour through some of the material that's come up there. This one, which is the Dutch-American expedition to New Guinea in 1926, and is, I think, a really interesting precedent to our event, which had occurred just 22 years earlier, and opens... obviously, they're not into electronic sound recording and so forth at that stage, but they're able to make a lot of film. They take a lot of photographs. And so through the website, you can actually go and explore a lot of this material. They were using... similar issues too in terms of aviation, and I might say that Charles Mountford, when he first came up with this idea, was thinking that he might be able to get a ship for the Arnhem Land expedition, and they'd have their own flag and so forth, and be sailing around the coast. And I guess that wasn't a completely unrealistic ambition, because there was all this, you know, army and navy surplus, all these things that. That the military were getting rid of at that time, but they ended up deciding, oh no, it'll just be sort of cheaper to fly these guys around and you know, drop them here and there, and so that's why air transport became the main form of transport between bases in Arnhem Land. Examples of the sorts of documents, and so that again, you know, it's very important in terms of being able to research this stuff to be able to start correlating your photographic and your written documents, letters and so forth. Information here on the different collections that were generated and the way, quite similar to the material Sally was showing us. You've got a whole sort of press reaction, public reaction, and find this material very interesting because it shows the way, you know, a greater public engages imaginatively with these sorts of things. This time when the media is, in a way, opening up supposedly remote and obscure parts of the world.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.